Hey Ding Dongs, I'm Jamie.
I'm Richard.
And this is Explain It to Jamie, the political comedy podcast in which I, Jamie, a curious but innocent young man, have the complicated political happenings of the world explained to me by my good friend Richard Lamb.
Usually.
But today, it is another special episode as we sort of jump out of the world of politics and into the bedroom. This is our second sex episode featuring the lovely Steph Baptiste.
Welcome back, Steph.
Nice to be here, lads.
For the record, I for sure thought you were going to say jump out of the world of politics and directly into our own genitals. I thought for sure that was where you were going with that.
Well, not today, Miss Frizzle.
But would have been like, can you imagine that's going to happen? There's going to be a gritty Netflix reboot of the Magic School Bus where they like go into your wang.
Yeah.
Totally.
That should be like Bill Nye the Science Guy's new Netflix reboot. Yeah. They should pitch like Riverdale, like a sexy Magic School Bus reboot where everyone like Frenches or whatever, right. Whatever's
happening. Arnold and Carlos are like dating.
Yeah. We're going to make $1 billion with this idea.
Yeah.
If somebody doesn't steal it.
If only we can like apprehend the copyright to Magic School Bus.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think we could do
it. I bet the actual Magic School Bus would have an episode where they steal the copyright to their own show. And then that's like a copyright law show. Oh my God. No. I got to stop giving away free gold here.
You know what they'd call it?
What?
Rick and Morty.
Oh, no, Jamie.
So today, guys, we are going to be talking about three specific things. We're going to talk about harm reduction, in sex, kink, and polyamory.
My three favorite bands.
Thank you. Big ol'.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's a real world thumbs up.
Yeah.
Facebook like in real time for Richard and his band joke.
Yeah, so we're really excited to delve into these topics. And, you know, as we talk about these kind of things, we usually just unearth all kinds of mysterious questions and fears that we have. So we'll be delving into those too. So, Steph, thanks for joining us again.
It's good to be here.
And let's get into it.
Wahoo!
Yep. What do you think of our theme song, Steph?
I think it's pretty cute, I have to say.
Thank you.
We're fond of it. Richard's, we explained Richard's girlfriend and her friend are the ones singing it.
I did not know that.
Yeah, I'm very, very happy with them.
Is that you that goes,
explain it to Jamie?
No, it's them.
Oh.
They went for that.
Oh, I dig that.
Yeah, it was cool.
Yeah. It's like nine of their voices tracked on top of each other.
Cool.
Yeah, it's like they did all these different takes and they're all mixed in.
And we got it for free.
Yeah. Anyway, that's our episode on sex, folks. Tune in next time.
Let's open it up. We're going to start talking about harm reduction off the top, I think.
Yeah.
So to get the ball rolling with that. So, guys, what are the best ways to reduce harm of sex? Well, okay.
Now that's a super important point. You can absolutely reduce harms in sex. A condom is a great example. Mm-hmm. But harm reduction really doesn't apply to anything other than drug use and drug policies.
I was going
to
say, because I'm a Vancouverite, right? So I grew up among the safe injection site controversy. And so the harm reduction debate is like a well-ingrained debate in my mind, but I've never heard it applied to sex.
No, exactly. Mm-hmm. I think the most direct piece with sex is, in fact, the role that substances play in a lot of people's getting busy.
Now, that's interesting.
Yeah. Very interesting.
Yeah. Because there are websites, not devoted just to this, but A Page of Sexuality and You, for example, which is one of the sites I recommend to folks all the time because it's a Canadian source. It's kind of broad-based. You can look up lots of topics on sexuality and you. It's also bilingual because it's a Canadian resource. Mm. Sex and you. The page on drug-facilitated sexual assault is just a really important piece. And the studies that have been done about youth substance use in Canada talks a lot about the role that alcohol plays in teen rates of sexual assault, for example. So we just can't deny that piece when we're talking about parties and our kids and the stuff they might get up to and the condoms they might not think to use because they're out on some some substance that got them into this fun situation, but isn't really helping them maintain their sexual health while they're there.
Right. So in this case, you're speaking primarily about like recreational drug use at mm-hmm. parties and the like.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not and necessarily so, for sexual, like...
good point.
Right.
Yeah. Like, we're not talking Viagra as or a like, drug used to facilitate sex, yeah. for
or like
example.
Poppers, yeah. which I've only read about in encyclopedias.
tell us more about what you know about them, because they are kind of relevant.
Yeah, they're like... It's like a inhalable drug that's sold as a sexual, like, enhancer, kind mm-hmm. of, right?
Oh. Yeah. I guess I don't know what poppers are.
It's actually. Like leather cleaner, like literally. But apparently, oh, really? Apparently it has, like, very modest health impact. Like, it's actually not, it's legal. Like, that's the thing. You can buy them at sex shops and stuff like that. Because it's, like, it's literally, like, leather cleaner. Like, it's, like, not an illegal substance. Yeah. But in all the medical trials that I've ever heard about, it doesn't really hurt people. Like, it doesn't hurt your brain. It's mm-hmm. like a very short head rush, essentially, I mm-hmm. think, is the deal with it.
Yeah. Right. Is that one of those cases, though, in which it's like, you sort of like weed in that it's like not as bad as other stuff, so it gets the title of being not awful for you, or like, mm-hmm. is the science out? Or,
you know, the websites I read about it were like, scientists have never successfully harmed someone using poppers, no matter how hard they tried. So it appears it's like pretty decently safe on the grand spectrum of stuff you can buy and put in your body in order to mess yourself up.
You guys want to go get some
poppers? Yeah, exactly.
I mean, go get some. Have you not seen my pop kit?
Oh, my God.
Yeah. I don't hear about it as much as I used to, but you would say, Richard, that it's still kind of a thing.
Like, certainly I'm aware of them, and people I know are aware of them.
Yep. Okay. Yeah. Good stuff.
Wow.
Good
to know. Actually, that's interesting. I guess it's funny because that's one of the drugs that I've never really classified for myself. I've heard it used, like I think they mention it once or twice in The Wolf of Wall Street. You know, I've seen it, I've seen it talked about in movies, but I've never witnessed it being used or heard of anybody I know using it. Mm-hmm. At least in a specific anecdote, other than maybe someone saying like, "Oh yeah, I tried that once."
Interesting.
And another drug that comes up is Rohypnol. That's the tranquilizer that's used by vets, but it can be dropped in a drink. It's tasteless and odorless, and that's why it facilitates sexual assault, because it absolutely takes away the defenses of the person who's ingested it. It makes you almost forget what happened. Your muscles go limp, and you have no control over what happens after that.
And that's interesting, because it's also because it has a nefarious use, but it also has I don't want to say positive, but another use. I know friends of mine in the gay community use it. I think they call it G. The thing about Rohypnol is it only reacts the way that we think it does when mixed with alcohol. But when just taken, it replicates being drunk, which is why it's really popular in the gay community, is because you can take this drug, feel drunk, be drunk at the club.
But your erection works the way you want it to.
Your erection works the way it wanted to, and you don't put on pounds in the
areas. Sure, with beer and the sweetness of alcohol.
Exactly.
Yeah. Sure.
Exactly.
Okay, makes a lot of sense, actually.
Yeah. Which I was shocked when I was at a party and my friends were taking this drug. I was like, oh my God, you are willingly taking Rohypnol. They just have to be careful not to drink for the rest of the night.
But I think everything we talk about, especially in sexual health, it's got a bad connotation for some folks, raised on whatever messages made it bad for them. Mm. There's almost always another way to see it. Almost always. And so I think that's what I feel kind of excited about, that stuff that I used to think was only bad and wrong, I have humanized, and just more knowledge has brought me more understanding and more acceptance that some folks roll this way. It's what they want in their lives. And if I am going to not judge somebody for having an abortion, or not judge somebody for who they take to bed as long as it's consensual, I don't know that I get to have an opinion about what you ingest or anything else, too, right?
Right. Interesting. Okay, so when we're talking about harm reduction with these, we talked about two specific drugs. Is there another drug we want to... No, throw under the pyre.
Just
here?
one study that folks should know about. I just want to make sure I put the letters in the right order. It's the Canadian Alcohol and Drug Use Monitoring Survey. It's an annual thing, and it looks at the illicit drug use of Canadians 15 and up. And I think what is always a surprise for folks is that alcohol has to be considered when we talk about drug use. A lot of folks don't, right? So they think, I don't have a problem with drugs, but that poor loser does.
Right.
How much wine do you drink every single day when you get home from work? If that's your habit, you've got your relationship to substances different from someone else's, but not necessarily any better or less harmful, potentially, right? So youth in Canada, without a doubt, alcohol is the drug they're using most. Cannabis is on the list, and that's an important one we should talk about probably because it's the Liberals are set to legalize it July 1st next summer.
Actually, that was, I believe, episode 14.
Hey, that's right. Okay, yeah. So you know all about that.
We do, yes.
And next time we're going to talk about a bunch of other stuff that's related to sex and the law and what Canadian governments are doing around various aspects of sexuality, but we'll get to that next time. Things we're really concerned about with young people too, though, are like energy drinks. Those whack kids out when they're mixed with alcohol and other caffeinated substances. Like you go to Starbucks and then you have an energy drink and then you put alcohol in the mix. That can really screw a kid up.
Jamie and I have talked many times. We used to be heavy energy drink users, especially in like the heady days of like the Fringe Festival in Edmonton, where Jamie and I would do sometimes between 20 and 30 performances in a 10-day period.
Yeah.
Like we were hitting those things hard. And even as we were doing it, I remember saying to him once, like, I feel like like our grandchildren will look at our energy drinks the way like we look at like cigarette ads from the 1930s, where it's like, nothing ameliorates pregnancy like Cools, like Slim Jim, you know, it's like, how do they believe that? It's like, that's what energy drinks will be like in the future.
Marlboro, doctor's favorite brand, or whatever.
When I was in university, I came to coffee very, very late. I started drinking it maybe when I was 24, 25. Okay. And
yeah, when we met, you only drank
tea. Energy drinks.
Energy drinks.
No, right. I didn't drink tea.
You didn't drink tea. That's right. You told me it was just leaves and twigs and water.
Yeah. I didn't like warm drinks for whatever reason.
Yeah.
Sure. You know, for whatever strange reason. And so in university, while everyone else was, you know, building their new love of coffee, I still didn't like it, and so I only drank energy drinks. And I drank about an energy drink a day, honestly, my whole way through university.
Which is like four coffees.
And it's like, yeah, it's insane.
It's like a lot of coffees, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And there was one day it was after I graduated, just in the middle of the day I was drinking an energy drink, and I had like a pain in my chest, a sudden pain. And I thought to myself, I was like, okay, I'm 23, I'm having a heart attack, and it's because of all these energy drinks I've been drinking. And it wasn't a heart attack, and I was fine. But, like, it bothered me that my brain just, like, went there and was like, oh, yeah, here's the reason that this is happening, and now you're going to die for the lamest reason.
Self-induced cardiac arrest at 23 is a bad
exactly end. Yeah, exactly. Sure. So I severely cut down. Mm-hmm. I still drink energy drinks before I do it, like improv shows or stuff like that.
But check yourself up.
Now I'm pretty hooked on the coffee.
I don't want to make this digression too long, but like one year I used to teach at a summer camp for improvisers, and one year we had like three crates or like three flats of energy drinks for the staff. And they said on them, you're not supposed to drink more than two a day. Like they're the little narrow cans, like the kind of original sized energy drinks. And we were all working really hard and tired. So sometimes people would have more than two and they would become furious. Like, and we started these were called Red Rain, the energy drinks, and we started saying, like, you're red raging.
Yeah.
Because if you had more than two, you would get, like, really short tempered and angry. Yeah.
Which is so good in a camp counselor.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
It was just funny that, like, there was such a strong correlation between, like, becoming the Incredible Hulk and drinking too many energy drinks. Like it was like, stop drinking these. They're clearly horrible.
They're bad for you.
And that sweet spot, I think, with any drug, right? They're like, where does this hit become the one I OD on? Or where does this good buzz become the one that makes me do stupid things that hurt my friend's feelings or lose my erection or whatever else is going to have a negative impact on the sex I want to have tonight? And this buzz that got me into the zone and now wrecked it because I went one drink too far or whatever.
Right. So if I can kind of like tie a bow around this whole part of it. It's like looking at harm reduction with regards to substances as like an adjacent thing to your sexual activity. It's like if substances are in the mix with our with sex, you need to know the best practices about those substances and ways to keep yourself healthy with the substance use as a part of your sex.
And we have to acknowledge that an awful lot of sex happens with that adjacent product in somebody's system, you know, and that's the point. That is the direct point for why we're going to smoke this joint together before we get at it or whatever. And the reduced inhibitions of alcohol at a party, for example, like I will not be able to get sexual if I don't loosen myself into the zone a little bit, right? And or the nefarious use, which is I will absolutely ply you with whatever substance to make sure I can get into your pants later.
Yeah, well, I was thinking about that in preparation for this podcast. I was thinking about that the other day. I was trying to think of the last date I went on in which we didn't have alcohol at it. At least like a first date or like or whatever. But I don't know that I can think of it. I think, you know, every date
kind of goes hand in hand.
Exactly. Exactly. At least, you know, at least one.
Which
or
is
two.
It's a funny joke. Really, what's in your other hand?
Actually, I only drink out of a plastic helmet that has like two straws coming out of the top.
Yeah, no, that's so very cool way to get a date started for sure.
There's my hands free for all the high fives I get.
There's one other substance I want to mention. It's not so much because of the sex component, but just because it's so relevant to youth in Canada, and that's prescription drugs. And not only Canada, but Ontario specifically, we have a very big problem with overprescribed opioids that are getting into the hands of young people, and it's not like they're picking them up off the floor at a rave. They're going into their grandmother's medicine cabinet and taking ones she hasn't used. So if I can put out a public health message to the listeners, if there's any prescriptions in your medicine cabinet that you are not using and a young person might have access to them and you're not going to think about it because you're not using it anymore, take it to the pharmacist and get rid of them. They are a key source of how our young people are finding really troublesome stuff.
Honestly, demographically, you're much more likely to actually be literally talking to those young people on our show than you are to the people with the prescriptions. So you may want to address a message to them as well.
Yeah, be careful. Fair enough. And do be careful. And we haven't even talked about street drugs, right? Like the stuff you're buying from a dealer who you don't know, they might not even know what's in it. And in the age of fentanyl, we have no idea which grain is the right size to kill you, right?
Yeah.
So illicit substances are problematic for a whole bunch of reasons. And that's a harm reduction drug policy, right? If we can legalize stuff, we can regulate it, which means you really are getting the hit you signed up for. And we just got to be aware that somebody who hasn't used for a long time, this happens to folks coming out of jail, for example, after a period of incarceration where you haven't had your regular doses, your regular dose could be fatal. A lot of folks OD unintentionally when they get back into their lives because the hit they thought was the hit for them is too much for their body now that they've been off it for a while. So we just have to be really informed, and that's hard to do in a subject that's secretive because it's stigmatized. So any of the conversation we can be having kind of out like this saves lives. It really does.
Totally. Sometimes, I don't know, especially recently, I've been wondering if I've become an old man in that, like, me and Richard have talked about this before, of like, I feel like my real experimentation days with drugs are behind me. I'm not saying it'll never happen again or anything like that, but I have a lot less yearning to go out and try things like that anymore. We also talked about once the idea that all of those like anti-drug ads that we saw when we were kids are finally true, you know, where like literally a drug you could buy from the street could just kill you outright, and you know,
true.
And there's no real way to test it.
The fentanyl crisis has not really made its way all the way to Ontario yet, the way that it has in my hometown of Vancouver, where like
even Edmonton.
My anecdote about it is that I have a friend in Vancouver who's a Red Seal chef, and so as part of being a chef, he has to re-up his first aid training from time to time,
and it now includes naloxone.
And it doesn't just include naloxone. The instructor for the first aid course said that he had had three people overdose on fentanyl in his first aid class that month.
Oh, geez.
Wow.
Like,
yeah.
Chefs, as far as I know, they are a substance using population because of the hours they work, because of the stress they maintain.
Yeah.
It's part of the culture for a lot of folks working kitchens. So we got to be aware of that.
Yeah, it was a real eye opener. I do know a couple, one person specifically I grew up with is now dead because of fentanyl. Mm. But like, it was an eye opener for me when I found out that friends of mine are now, when they throw parties, buy a fentanyl kit and put it in the bathroom, and they're like,
just in case.
Yeah, just gotta. I mean, it's weird to buy and like keep, but like,
but
we'll put it in the bathroom. We're not encouraging the use of it, but if someone, it's better to have it and not need it.
I think you've just made a really important statement. We're not encouraging the use of it, but the use might happen.
Yeah.
And we are the person who put this party in place where somebody might choose to do that.
Yeah.
And as a responsible host who'd like all our friends to go home alive, let's just put it on the back of the toilet so anybody who needs it knows where to find it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's true, condoms in schools don't make young people have more sex.
Right.
But the ones who are doing it can maintain their sexual health a little better than they did without them.
Mm.
It's an important measure. And you also mentioned something about, you know when you want to tie something back up and then it's gone?
Yeah,
it's okay.
That's like how I have sex.
I was right there. No, I was bracing you to that joke. Don't feel bad about it. I was right there with that joke.
Oh, I know what it was. It was about the poster campaigns we all saw in our youth.
Yes.
Like, fear tactics don't work. They just make people make fun of them. And no means no, and yes means yes are too simple to embody the truth of how people are getting sexual or high.
Mm-hmm.
So I think honest conversation around all of this, and the harm reduction community is so good at that, whether we're talking about sex directly or not, we're just talking about substances. They're so good at acknowledging, I got no judgment of you, you're a human being, this drug is in your life for a whole variety of reasons, and I just want to make sure you get the hit you want and stay alive tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really hard concept for folks from the abstinence-only school of thought, but that's the other overlap with sex, right?
Yeah.
Like, abstinence-only does not make a lot of sense for most people who are driven by the sexual compulsions of being a sexual human being.
Well, that's one of the that's an interesting thing that I find that is a through line with sex and gender and drugs, is that it is it has been and is a largely binary conversation.
Mm.
And it, like, for me, the battle is not necessarily convincing, like, certainly not convincing people that, like, sex is positive or drugs are positive, because I feel like that's for, you know, everyone to work out. But I think, actually just getting them to say, it's not a black and white issue, it's not a yes and no issue, it's a gradient. And that's sort of the challenge I find when I'm talking to people who I disagree with, is not, I don't care if you see it exactly the way I see it, just as long as you stop seeing it as a yes and no.
Merely black and white.
Yeah.
And not only a gradient from individual to individual, but for each of us over our lifespan, we change our thinking about these things so thoroughly as we kind of grow away from the messages we were raised on. And becoming a parent is a really great way to recognize, ooh, do I want to just pass that on to the next generation the way I received it? Maybe I don't, actually. And that's your default. It's in there. Drugs are bad. I'll tell my kids to avoid them. Rather than, well, maybe I will tell my kids that I did mushrooms a number of times in undergrad, and I had a great time, actually, but I was with people I felt safe with.
Yeah.
And I got product from people I trusted. Or, like, the harm reduction measures that make drug use, kind of part of life for some folks. And but if you're going to do it, please do it in a way that keeps you safe, because I love you.
here's a contentious issue. I was talking about, I was in Detroit visiting my cousins, and they were talking about, it was one of their first year at university, and he was talking about how many people had to be taken to the hospital for alcohol poisoning in their first year.
In their first year.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Just like right away. And we were sort of talking about the idea of introducing alcohol to kids, as many, especially like romantic cultures do, like Italians, totally. And Spanish and French and
Italians.
Exactly, yeah. Bring mm-hmm. They start with a little Dixie cup of wine when they're 13 or whatever.
I have an Italian friend who talked about how this applies to alcohol, the way it applies to coffee. Kids get mostly milk and a little bit of coffee. Mm-hmm. And as you get older, you get less milk, more coffee. Same with red wine and ginger ale or something.
Yeah.
You get a little wee bit of red wine in your ginger ale, and as you get older, the ratio changes until you're a wine drinker.
And yeah, exactly. And the result is that when you turn 21 in the States,
you don't go 18, nuts.
No, you're not like, oh, great, this first time I'm an adult, I can handle all the booze in this store, you know? Yeah, and so, yeah.
And need my stomach pumped and whatever else needs to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure that's not an absolute. I'm sure that there's also people who irresponsibly are given alcohol as children and develop a bad relationship with
Without
it.
Without a doubt, it can still be problematic
and all that.
Needs to be supervised. A lot of kids have their first drink at home. Like, they get their prescription drugs from the medicine cabinet. They get their first booze from the liquor cabinet. And if it's unsupervised, that can be a real problem.
Yeah.
But it's kind of like this. It's like the same philosophy applied to all these substances, though. Like, you know, people like altering their consciousness with a variety of substances, legal and illegal. And the most important thing is that you like trust your source, or in a good situation with people who you trust, and learn your own doses and things like that in a safe way, so that you understand what you're in for and what kind of experience you're going to get.
Like, and people have been altering their state of consciousness for eons and across the planet in different ways. So, for us to think this is a new thing and all the kids are doing drugs now. People have been doing drugs forever.
Yeah, we just got more
let me tell you
drugs,
about a little thing called ancient Rome, Senator.
Yeah, they called it Athenian cocaine. Do we have anything more to add on the harm reduction? It seems like, you know, I don't want to simplify it too much, but you know, find your sources, as you said, know where it's coming from. Mm-hmm. Have, I think, if not parental, at least like a wizened person to talk to about this kind of thing and be open with about it.
Totally. I would say that's an important one. Not all parents are going to be comfortable with this stuff, and that's fair. They come to their stance for a reason, but find someone in your life or your child's life who they can trust, because it's important that they have someone they can go to with this, or at least hand them Kids Help phone number, because they deal with substances on that line all the time.
Right.
Couple other resources I wanted to mention, drugcocktails.ca. It's a really good new resource destined for young people and the mixing specifically of street drugs, prescription drugs, and alcohol, so that we understand what's a risky combination and how to
That's so interesting, because I think of anywhere where that information would have been available to me when I was growing up.
No. For sure. And it's just become critical from a public health perspective that we share this with young people, because we're losing too many of them now,
you know,
for lack of information and some pretty adventurous mixing. And one other thing, Canadian Harm Reduction Network, they describe themselves. I just want to make sure I honor their way of putting it. They call themselves the virtual meeting place for individuals and organizations dedicated to reducing the social, health, and economic harms associated with drugs and drug policies. So I guess if I could end on any note, it's kind of the parent perspective versus the regulator perspective. As a parent, I get it. You don't want your kids doing this. But as a person who works in the field, as an educator, it's kind of my job to make sure people have the information in front of them that helps them make healthy decisions with, right? So the research is telling us that harm reduction works better than any abstinence models. And so that is enough for me to keep doing the work I believe in.
Great. Well, guys, should we put on our handcuffs and...
And what else do we believe in?
Suspended upside down from the ceiling with a 7-foot plug in my butt this whole time.
it's amazing.
I don't know about you.
It's amazing that you still managed to be able to talk out of your ass. We'll be here all week.
Man, that was a fierce roast. I'm going to need a really long hit from my plastic beer helmet to dull the pain of that one.
Dull the pain of the 7-foot plug. Yeah. Jesus.
I'm not even 7 feet tall, or am I? You don't know. You've only heard my voice.
He wasn't before the plug went in.
Yeah.
His skull is now significantly higher than
it's
me.
Like, it's like foot binding.
Yeah.
It's like a beauty thing. Okay, so kink.
Kink.
Pow!
Yeah, so, okay. When I,
do we define it?
I think we should. When I think of kink, I think my mind immediately goes to BDSM. And sort of stops there.
Yeah, and I think that's a good way to start the definition, actually, yeah. Is do we know what those letters stand for, everybody?
Bondage, domination, and sadomasochism?
You missed one. Oh. There's a fun overlap. The first, the B and the D are bondage and discipline. The D and the S are dominance and submission. The S and the M are sadism and masochism. Oh, so you had all the right pieces, but there's an overlap in the middle.
So really, it's
cool. No other acronyms work like that. Why would they do that? That's confusing.
I guess they
maybe because they're messing
BDS
with all kinds of stuff.
Oh wow!
And they don't care how everybody else is doing it.
So cool. I just got spanked in acronym.
Yeah. Okay. So actually,
yeah,
let's
and let's
do this
admit
again.
It. BDDSSM.
Yeah,
it's not just sounds a bit mouthy.
Right. It's not as
like
yeah.
So go ahead,
so
say it again.
Bondage.
And discipline.
Discipline, dominance,
and submission.
Sadism
and masochism.
Mm-hmm.
Aha.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
That's the definition. And hey, my expertise might stop there, right?
Right.
But if nothing else, because my personal life is not what we're here to discuss, but also because I want to be clear, harm reduction is something I know about. I am not an expert. It is part of my work, but I do not work specifically, uniquely in harm reduction.
Right.
Yeah. Kink is on everybody's radar right now. Everybody's playing with spanking and floggers and blindfolds and light bondage or whatever. Where that becomes actually a member of the kink community and being supported by all of those resources, that's different. And I just want to acknowledge a few resources and kind of put that caveat out there,
right,
that my sex life is not something I'm going to talk about, and my professional life does not make me an expert in kink.
Right.
It gives me the good fortune to know a lot of really smart people who are doing good work in that domain. Certainly gives me a perspective I can offer a caller who needs counseling or a young person who's looking to get some questions asked less judgmentally than they might find it elsewhere. But I just want to put that out there, that there are lots of guest speakers in the kink community who can serve this topic more fully than I can.
Caller who needs counseling or a counselor
who needs
a caller.
Well, so for the purposes of our podcast then, like, consider us like we're calling you for your line, and just maybe gave us the basis. If I'm, you know, 17 years old and I'm calling you and I'm going, I don't understand what this even is.
Mm.
Will you help me clarify this word I keep hearing? What would you say to that person?
That's a really great way to put the question. I guess I'd want to always start with the caller. What else do you know about it? How did that word come to you? Have you seen one of the 50 Shades of Grey movies, for example?
Are we talking about kink right now, or BDDDS?
Well, that's interesting. Are they interchangeable? Do you have an understanding that maybe they're not?
Well, I'm wondering if kink, does it stop at BDSM, or does it, I guess it can, you know, to play on my own gradient conversation I brought up earlier, probably not. It probably does color outside the lines of that a little bit.
Coloring outside the lines is human sexuality, so I guess I would just sort of put that on the table as a, We can try to wrestle things down to a clear definition, but most things, like we said last time, don't suit themselves very well to a boxed-in definition, because it will be really different for one person to another, and for one person 20 years from now than the sex they're having today.
Right. So. I guess, okay, when I think of the word kink, I think of, there was a TV show when I was growing up that I would watch late at night on Showcase, because porn on the internet didn't exist yet.
Not
for me.
Quite yet.
So I would watch this TV show called Kink, and it was it's hard for me to look back at it as an adult, but as a kid, it struck me as like alternative sexual lifestyle to what a family man and woman of the 1960s would deem like regular sex. You know, it was sort of like all encompassing for that, of like anything that's out of the ordinary. Maybe, you know, Don Draper would be like, oh, that's not for me, you know. Mm-hmm. That's sort of what
I have a feeling, yeah. Don would have been up for just doing any of that, but whatever.
Yeah, that is true.
Don was a sexual beast. I also think we can't kid ourselves that regular couple aren't the folks who are doing it.
Mm.
We have no idea, because so few people feel really genuinely comfortable talking about this openly. And you and I have talked to Jamie about things we've said to other folks that we can feel while we're saying it, the judgment's coming. And yeah. I feel kind of criticized and creepy for what I'm telling you. And yeah. So we learn very quickly who we can't trust with this truth.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, maybe I haven't found anybody I can trust, so I'm just going to keep it to myself, mm-hmm. and get on FetLife and hope to find other people who understand what I'm talking about, right? Mm-hmm. There's another resource, kinkontario.com. I don't know tons about them, but what I see is helpful. It's got a real educational stance. Mm. It's not merely a hookup opportunity. That's definitely part of it, gathering community at parties so folks can find each other. But they're really good about the etiquette, about the safer sex piece, about cleaning your toys or right. when blood sports are involved, how to keep yourself safe from infection and stuff. So
blood sports.
if you're gonna do any whipping or chains or cutting that might actually break the skin, we're now not just talking about sexual fluids, we're talking about blood involved, and bloodborne infections like hep C or HIV can be transmitted that way. Menstrual blood can transmit those viruses as well, right? So
right.
any blood involved just needs to be paid attention to.
I find it very hard not to pay attention to blood when it's around.
When I just hear the term blood sports, I think of like a seedy underground room where a bunch of businessmen are watching three homeless people fight a grizzly bear or something. Like that's like
wow.
that's what that image is in my mind. Wow. So that was a shocking term to hear.
Yeah, one of the homeless men is played by Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Yeah, that's right.
in the famous
and he's
movie.
Just
it's weird that he maintains that physique on one slice of white bread a day.
Yeah. It is incredible.
I don't know.
And those grizzly bears never saw it coming.
No.
Mm. Okay.
But I think that's crucial what you just said too, that the stereotype of where we go, like sex work is a good one for me in terms of what I have learned away from the holy stigmatized, sensationalized stereotype of a crack whore, downtown Montreal, doing anybody all the time and barely making enough money to pay rent or her pimp or whatever. Like that happens. Don't get me wrong. There are some very vulnerable people getting paid for sex. But there's a lot more variety to the work they do and the people they interact with and the lives they live. So just to put blood sports in context, there might be some people having some really difficult stuff they're working through with their blood sports. Or there might be some who are finding it really healing and just kind of new stimulation. And there, I don't know, there are things about cutting that makes sense to me, for example. Somebody, and I'm drawing a picture on my wrist of actually a lethal suicide slice of my wrist. But in fact, cutting is usually more horizontals across the arms. And, and you know, that has ancient traditions too, and scarification and all kinds of stuff. But the picking of a scab so you can control the pain and the blood when you have been harmed makes a lot of sense to me psychologically. Like I do understand how people find healing from something that on the outside looks only destructive. And yes, they need support. They need some help and some love and some non-judgment. But there are things about that psychology that make more sense than we might think off at the surface.
Yes.
So we just need to pay attention to why people are doing what they're doing.
Here's something interesting. Since we started talking about this, I've been trying to frame in my mind a question to the effect of something like, why is this stuff even so underground? You know, obviously people are private about their sexualities, but why is this considered so out of the mainstream? But then when we started talking about whipping and chains and whatnot, I realized it arouses me negative 100%. You know what I mean? I find it like just any of the language we've been using is completely non-sexualized to me. Mm-hmm. And so I guess it's I guess what I'm starting to realize is like the stuff that we think of as like vanilla mainstream, using heavy air quotes here, sex, is maybe the stuff that is like undeniable to most people. Right. You know what I mean? And something that is, once you actually start to legitimize and understand the full spectrum of what people consider to be sexual activity, you do touch on things that are just not arousing at all for a certain subject of the people.
And the feeling of being aroused by it is confusing, right? It's like, right. I shouldn't like that this is hurting somebody. Like, that goes against all of our trying to reduce sexual assault and increase consensual interactions, you know? But that's the truth of it. There's a lot of ambiguity and confusing feelings in human sexuality. And so that's okay, too, that it's not your kink, that it's not your turn on. Great. We're learning about it, and we're trying to understand that it is important to some folks. They find meaning in it. But doesn't have to be your thing.
So then is there often or sometimes a like coming out process with kink and stuff like that? And with people, I imagine, like you said, it must be isolating and scary. And there probably, unless you have a way into these communities which teach you how to safely and consensually express these things, there is the potential for abuse and harm or just, you know, self-loathing.
And that's a big piece of the caller, the hypothetical caller you were talking about. Folks are trying all kinds of wild stuff, and if they don't have the support of a community around them, educating them about how to pull hair right, how to spank responsibly, how to reduce bruising or recognize that somebody with low iron is going to bruise a lot, and the arnica gel might help, but it's actually the rubbing that disperses the fluids that's going to help reduce the bruising. And some people don't want to reduce the bruising. That's my badge of honor. I got that in a good time, and I want you to know I can handle that. Whatever anybody's relationship to, and that's not a blood sport, but blood's right at the surface, right? That's what a bruise is. So we just, I gave so much preface, I forgot where I was going. Oh, that caller. That folks are getting up to some wild, wild stuff and can really hurt each other if they're not doing it responsibly and respectfully. So I guess, again, I'd like it out of the closet, out in the open, where people do feel safe to come out about some of the things they're interested in trying so that they can get that guidance. And then not foist their tastes on someone who's not interested in it, but find someone who'd really like it if you did that to them, actually. Because they exist, and the internet has sure helped people find each other that way.
Well, you and I were talking about that before. I wonder... a few years ago, I did a play called Venus in Fur, which was which your husband worked on here, and we were approached. Me and my castmate were approached by some people that my castmate knew who were big into the domination culture, and we were invited to a party.
Just to educate you?
Well, they said, they're like, you can be a fly on the wall, or you can partake, and we didn't take them up on it. I think we were both, our partners were out of town, and we felt
kind of freaked out,
strange about it. And but we did take an interview with some people to talk about it. And I said, you know, I was like, this is in some of the talkbacks. I was like, this is actually one of the scariest plays I've ever had to do, because like my mom is coming to see this and my dad, and you know, and I myself, am not interested in that personally, and so like to pretend, it felt more vulnerable than I'd ever been on stage, like pretending to enjoy being punished the way I was. And anyway, the point I'm trying to make is there seems to be a codified community, and it's a matter of like that community reaching the mainland a little bit. And you and I were talking about how it historically, I don't want to speak too far back, but it seems to be a newspaper, classifieds way of reaching out. Now we were talking about there are new apps and stuff like that, and
lots
websites
of ways to hook up now. Folks are finding other couples on Craigslist.
So is there like a 50 Shades of Grey effect that's been visible with like the mainstreaming of this stuff?
Yes, for sure.
Yeah,
for sure. I think if you spoke to the owner of any sex shop in Toronto, they would say, "Oh, absolutely. We've seen a spike in requests for handcuffs and paddles and floggers and whatever else."
Right.
And I just always to humanize it. Right. One thing I will share, because I participated personally, out of curiosity, but also professionally. I want to know about these things. Mm-hmm. And there happens to be a really glorious resource in our city. It's a meetup called Playful Loving. Mm-hmm. But the woman who runs it, Lady Victoria, is a very skilled, very compassionate practitioner of all kinds of sexual arts. And she really wants people to feel empowered to have the sex they want and not be too ashamed of their expression and just be supported with good information. And I took a flogging workshop with her. And a flogger is like a, can be a handle made of glass or leather or wood, a variety of things. And then it has fabric or rope or leather or plastic or rubber falls off the end, like a horse's tail almost. Mm-hmm. And it is used for smacking the body, and some people really like that sound. Other people like you can feel the air when the falls go past you. If you close your eyes, there's all kinds of really exciting sensations that I wouldn't have expected. You just hear about the impact, right? But the way she described it was that it's just an extension of your hand. It's just another way to show love or connection or stimulation. It's like a massage. And she taught us about the parts of the body that can take that, because they're large muscle groups. You don't put it on bony parts. You don't put it on mucous membranes, which are more vulnerable tissue, unless somebody wants that. You know, folks can surprise themselves about how much they liked it when the falls licked around my butt cheek and got me on something a little more vulnerable, and I liked it. Pain is almost always associated with something negative, but pain can be just part of life. Like it's how we get our babies born. It can be just the little extra stimulation people are looking for. I don't know if sex has gotten dull for them or they've gotten too used to their vibrator and they want to find other ways to get themselves there, whatever.
Yeah. I often, I try and think of it as a, and correct me if I'm wrong, as like a new, like, variety of communication. Because I feel like, you know, more and more as I mature and my sexual life gets better, I find the thing that attracts me the most is the communication that's happening during sex. And not necessarily verbally, like, verbally is fine, but, like, the, you know, the physical understanding of, oh, what I'm doing feels good for this person right now. Mm-hmm. Or, oh, I'm letting this person know subtly what they're doing feels good. Mm-hmm. And for, you know, it just seems to up the variety of things, of ways to communicate.
Totally.
A friend of mine who's into that community says that she herself, she doesn't, does domination, and she herself doesn't, it's not the act that she enjoys. She enjoys watching the person react. Mm-hmm. So like she's like, I don't like hitting people or causing people pain, but the person that I'm with, I can see them really enjoying it, and that turns me on.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I don't want to be prescriptive or say like that's it, that's the case for everybody, but I can understand it in that way of like, oh, it's just a new way of communicating. And yes, it's using pain receptors instead of necessarily pleasure receptors.
I know, it's interesting, isn't it?
I don't want to say that.
We've put pain and pleasure on a binary that makes them opposites. Not necessarily the case for everybody. They too are on a gradient.
Right, right. Interesting. Mm-hmm. I love that. Yeah. You talk yourself into a hole real quickly.
Well, and the complexity is greater than we can imagine, right? It's a that's for me, not for me. That's for you, not for you. Folks get up to stuff later on that they never knew they were going to be curious to try in their earlier days of sexuality, right? For us to forget that sex evolves over the lifespan is one of our greatest flaws of our youth-obsessed culture, right?
Mm.
For a lot of folks, sex gets challenging as they get older. There's no doubt. But if we put some resources to that, sex can get better than it ever has been.
Right. Here's not to get too far away from the point, we were talking about mainstream kink, or kink like emerging into the mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
I would wonder, and also put out that are there people, I'm sure there are, that, you know, the thing about their sexuality that they like is that it's done in a attic of a house party was secretly, you know, I'm a dentist in my regular life, but nobody knows what I get up to.
And often the folks who want to be dominated, it's a lot of middle-aged men making really good money who make a lot of decisions in a high-powered work environment, and they want somebody else to take the reins, like literally take the reins, and I will go wherever you want me to go, and you will whip me while it's happening, and I will kind of love the surrender of control and the facade that I got this. I can make all the decisions. I got this. I can run a budget, multi-million dollar budget. In this case, I will be your baby. I will be whatever weakness is for that person, right? And it gives them pleasure. And they pay good money for it a lot of times.
Wow. Yeah, it's very complicated.
It is. It is very complicated.
Yeah, reading the book Venus and Fur, not the play, but which is where masochism comes
about
from,
the Marquis de Sade,
from Sacha Masoch. But like I had to read it three times to really have a good take on it. I remember the first time was kind of confused as to what it all means and what he got out of it. Second time I was like, oh, okay, I get it, this is what he wants. And the third time I've never had my opinion flip so drastically on a character's objective with every read.
And I do love that about theater. It does force you to get into the skin of somebody who's doing things you could not imagine yourself doing. Maybe you're the abusive husband. Maybe you're whatever. And I just think it does help us understand human complexity and to humanize something that might be otherwise really easy to judge. And to, you know, not excuse violence that isn't appropriate, or the violence that isn't wanted, violence that's harming somebody. But there's a lot of ways to roll in the world, you know, and the longer we live, the more we see that, and hopefully the more we can open our mind to some of that.
So before we move on to polyamory, I would like to come back to sort of the initial question of like, how would you, if I'm a 17-year-old calling you curious, how would you define kink?
That's a tricky one, because I get too vague sometimes to be useful for folks. So I didn't actually look it up to write it down. Just like, what does kink mean? It's harder to find, right? Because yes, there would be a dictionary definition, but how an individual kinkster defines it for themselves is, I think, that lived experience may be a little more relevant, because a lot of the kind of mainstream definitions of it will be pathologizing. They will be ostracizing or othering, like that's an alternative lifestyle rather than something regular parents might involve in their own sex lives. I don't know. I don't know. I guess I would, you know, start with the young person. What have you read, or where has this come from? What does kink mean to you? And then use those as starting points. And the big things that I would always come back to are consent, safety, communication, respect, connection, just to not in a shut somebody down way, but just make sure that this is fully incorporated in who you are and the sex you want. And I don't know, it's an interesting one. I guess it's so related to that individual and how they would word it,
right?
And the emotional tone in their voice. If they seemed threatened by this, I would handle the call very differently than if they seemed super, super jazzed up about this.
Interesting. So let's move on to our final point of polyamory.
That I do have a definition for.
Okay.
Interestingly enough, just because there's a poly podcast, I thought you lads should know about it.
Hey.
Polyweekly.com.
Maybe we can get together and switch partners.
There you go.
Jamie's renting me out.
Renting you. That's nice. Rather than pimping you.
Yeah.
So that's run by a woman named Cunning Minx and a man named Lusty Guy. And they do their weekly podcast.
What progressive parents they must have.
I also feel like he could have have worked a little bit harder on his name.
Yeah. I happen to think Cunning Minx is significantly more clever as a handle.
I got a tingle up my spine when he said that. And then the Lusty who? Guy was just a bit clinical.
Yeah. I'd say, are you kidding? Anyway.
It's me, Shiver Down Your Spine, and my co-host, Sex Man.
Yeah, exactly. With the beer vat on his head and his jaw.
Sex Man.
Frat boy, really. Truly. Lusty guy.
But I imagine that came from a message board at some
point.
I
don't have a clue what their backstory is.
That sounds like a message board name to me.
Maybe.
Yeah. No, man. They're
without
accountants.
A doubt. Without a doubt, it's their kind of pseudonym. But they describe, or they define poly as having multiple long-term loving relationships with the full knowledge and consent of all parties involved. Mm-hmm. And that full knowledge and consent is a significant piece, because if it's not ethical, it's not polyamory. It's just cheating or swinging or... Mm-hmm. And swinging can be the full knowledge and consent of all parties because you're in the room when it's happening, but swinging sort of implies that there's not going to be an ongoing relationship with those folks. It's more anonymous hookups at a sex club, whereas polyamory can lead to a quad, for example, where two couples live together, raise each other's kids, you know, you got extra adults to get everybody to hockey practice, and everybody knows that there are intimate relationships amongst all the players.
Right.
Maybe not all the neighbors, because that's hard to be really out very safely in a lot of places.
Mm-hmm.
But the children know that they have a variety of parents, not just the bio ones.
Interesting. Now, are there any statistics on how many people are actually in fully functional, stable, like familial, parental poly relationships? Like, how common is that?
Yeah, it's more common than we would think, because the folks who are doing it well are probably doing it quietly. Dan Savage talks a lot about, lots of people are in open relationships. Many of them just don't know it.
Right.
And he does always reinforce the point, you probably do know someone who's living that way. They just aren't real talkative about it because of the judgment they get.
Right.
And maybe they do want to protect their kids because they're not sure the classroom teacher is going to be able to handle this relationship structure.
Right.
You know, we've seen how challenged folks are by same-sex parenting or even solo parenting, you know, single parenting or multi-generational family structures. There's so much diversity in the way we live as family groups in a home, right?
Mm-hmm.
That poly is just one of the other relationship arrangements, but it does provoke a lot of judgment from a lot of folks. But anyway, so yeah, in terms of numbers, I'm not sure anybody can do that research because they're not going to get enough honest answers from enough people to really know if they've found the truth.
That's fascinating.
Now, as you say that, I'm realizing maybe I think my definition of polyamory has been not full up until now. So so polyamory includes the relationship. So would the opposite be like if you're just in an open relationship, but you're allowed to go off and have flings with people? Would that just be ethical non-monogamy? Is that how you would define that?
Yeah,
or
maybe.
Would that be polyamory?
Maybe that's
as well?
The difference. But you know, when I word it, I tend to do the polyamory / ethical non-monogamy or consensual non-monogamy. But yeah, there are again so many ways to define it, right? And I'm not sure nailing it down is important.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what I'm hearing as a through line through all of this is that, like, if you know people who are doing different sexual stuff than you in your life, it's much more important to just like understand and listen to their context than to try to figure out which labels to attach to them. It's probably like a good way to approach
totally.
Your world.
Mm. Labeling it is natural though. Like our brain does need to reduce the amount of stimulation it has to categorize in order to make it manageable, right?
Right?
So a label helps us do that. It's kind of a natural human urge. But there's a great book called Urban Tantra, for example. And the author talks about try to surrender your need to understand, the need to answer the question why, because that can often feel like judgment. Like unless I can figure out a good reason for this, I'm not okay with what you're doing.
Right.
Rather than I accept that you got a different way of rolling than I have.
Mm-hmm.
I'm challenged by it, but that's my work to do, not necessarily yours to fix.
Mm-hmm.
That would solve an enormous number of problems that we have.
Wouldn't it?
Yeah,
in all kinds of topics, not just sexuality.
It's kind of, it is kind of at odds, though, with our Well, and this sort of goes back to the point I was making last podcast, a couple podcasts ago, around the idea of nature not necessarily being moral. Nah, no, that's not the way to enter into this conversation. Humans need to define things, go, this is what this is. I know what this is. I found myself, you're not going to talk about your sexual anecdotes, but I will. I'll talk about your sexual anecdotes. I have had the conversation of an open relationship before, and what this means, and what... my first time having that conversation was really challenging, not in a bad way, in a very exciting way. Mm-hmm. And my partner was, she was more experienced at that before. She'd had those before. So I said, I was like, okay, well, in my, rational Jamie way, I was like, okay, well, what are the rules? Like, what are, should I read a book? Does a book have all the rules on it? And she's like, well, here's the thing. She's like, reading books is great. Read books.
It is.
Yeah.
It opens new thoughts that you can't have anticipated.
Read books. But at the end of the day, the only thing that matters is that we are completely upfront with each other and working through things together. It's as soon as you're hiding things that resentment builds and people get blindsided. So she's like, we can develop rules for this and all of that, and that's great, but we, like, every polyamorous relationship is different, and this is going to include, we have to just stay communicative. That's the only rule.
I have heard those named in a variety of different ways: courageous conversations, delicate conversations, collaborative conversations. I think collaborative might be the one I'm starting to appreciate best. Takes a lot of courage sometimes to launch these things, because I've heard lots and lots of people say, I'm into exploring open, but I know my partner isn't. And as soon as you take that as a non-negotiable starting point, you guys are kind of done, right? And it does squash conversation, but it does take a lot of courage to say, now I hear you, you're less into this than I am, but are there points of overlap, because I need to explore this? And that's a piece that our kind of monogamous cultural context doesn't allow a lot of space for. The person who's been cheated on gets lots of emotional support, and that fucker who left you in the lurch. The person who did the cheating, and I put that in heavy air quotes, gets almost always universally, uniformly lambasted. And there's just, there has to be some acceptance that we have differing levels of libido. And that makes itself really apparent in a long-term monogamous relationship. And we all have different sexual truths that we want to explore. And is there a way for me to get this little piece that I want, because it helps me stay with us, in a way that doesn't really threaten you or hurt you? And it might threaten you and hurt you, and we got to acknowledge that that's the truth of it.
Right.
And that's why the conversations are so difficult.
Well, and it's like, separate from the sexual act of cheating on somebody or not, I think it's like, it revolves so much around just your moral character as a human being, too. Like, how you... There's this improv saying, there are no bad offers, there are only bad follow-throughs. Now, I would say that if you cheat on somebody and that's not a part of your your relationship's contract, that is a bad thing you did. But then the way that you follow up on that is extremely important. You know what I mean?
A lot of people survive cheating, right? Yeah. A lot of couples can make their way through it because they get surprising amounts of understanding from the person who's been jilted.
Yeah.
It's like, I guess I saw that one coming, and we could have talked about this earlier rather than after the fact.
Totally. And I've been in relationships too where, well ahead of, like, you know, very early on, someone has said, I've, like, been cheated on, and it was very traumatic for me, and I just have zero, like, I cannot handle
zero
it
tolerance
at all. And, you know, I was like, well, I'm not planning on doing that, but I'm glad we had this conversation that's clear going forward.
Yeah,
you know what
for
I mean?
Sure.
Yeah. Mm.
For sure. And most folks have an experience of being cheated on, or just a lack of emotional safety that, can I trust this partner, right?
Yeah.
It is part of the sexual terrain. It's part of what makes sex difficult for all the good things that come of it. That's one of the really hard truths about sex for anybody, whether it's poly they're debating or some other aspect of sex. One thing I wanted to mention, if anybody's got something else brewing, go there, because I'm not making the link.
I got this sweet home kombucha brewing in this closet.
Hey,
pop that open.
Sure thing. Might if I stick in some poppers? I just happened to bring some.
You can't. That ruins. You mean like inhale the poppers and then drink it, or pour the poppers in the kombucha? Because that would make it poison.
Yeah, I put poppers in my eyeballs.
Jamie. Oh my God, your eyes are just gaping black holes.
Would you say they're popping?
No, I wouldn't. I would not say you need to go to the hospital.
Not yet clear on the concept of poppers.
Yeah, I wish listeners, you could see what Jamie was doing with his shoulders and head while he said the word popping. They're kind of all undulating.
It's popping. No locking.
We need to show only you popping. Some YouTube videos and also take you to a doctor.
Okay.
Ooh, do you know, I think I've got the piece that I forgot.
Great.
Thank you for filling the gap.
Okay.
So entertaining.
Well, it's too late. We're talking about kombucha and poppers.
Good
now.
Point. Okay, go over to you. You were talking about the folks who've been hurt by it and they've put up really clear parameters. Whether somebody's been hurt or not, some folks just don't roll outside monogamy. Monogamy works for them.
Yeah.
It makes a lot of sense to them. They feel best, they feel their freest sexually when they are in something long-term and dependable, and my partner feels that same way, and we both go comfort first, maybe comfort over adventure. We don't need adventure. We need safety. We need familiarity. This is what makes us happy sexually. Mm-hmm. So I want to be really, really clear that I am not advocating poly for all and that it's the only evolved way to be sexual. Monogamy serves a lot of people very, very well because it is an equally human drive to partner and to have security. Right? To build community around children or whatever else brings us together as pairs. Mm-hmm. But for an awful lot of people, they could prevent some very difficult deceit and divorce scenarios.
Right.
If they could have slightly more courageous or collaborative conversations around inviting others, even if it's just their energy, into their binary situation. There's a great, great book called Mating in Captivity by Esther Perel. She's Belgian, I believe. French-speaking, but Belgian, not French. Am I right? Anyway, fantastic author. Really important voice on the topic of extramarital relations. Mm-hmm. And her book talks a lot about reconciling the erotic and the domestic, that it's important that this person who brings me coffee every day keeps doing that. Mm-hmm. And yet some of the people in the most seemingly functional relationships are crazy with boredom, desperate to look for something else to fire them up and feel wanted and a reason to work out and a reason to buy lingerie, whatever. Yeah. Whatever it is, right? But the sexual satisfaction is an important human drive. And so is comfort.
Mm.
And the two don't always go together super comfortably.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And as has been the theme, there's a gradient of all of it.
Exactly.
I was talking with everything I contribute to this is anecdotal. I understand that, and I'm just going with
it. I think that's why we're here, right? Enough anecdotes to want to bring in the sexual health perspective.
That's right. I was talking with a friend of mine, and they are in a, not an open, they wouldn't consider themselves polyamorous or open,
okay.
But it's the flirting is the thing that they have identified as a
yes.
problem in previous relationships of like, oh, it's not that I want to go out and sleep with people, it's that I want to go out and be sexy
and feel
when people want to have sex with me and feel like, you know, feel that attraction. And I think it took them having obviously big conversations, going outside and saying, okay, no, we're going to try having sex with other people. That seems to be the solution. And then understanding after trying
pull
that,
back a bit.
Yeah, they go, oh, we actually don't need that. That's not the enjoyable part. It's the idea that I can go out on a Friday night, go to a party without my partner, be attractive, or even with my partner. You know, she was saying that it's attractive for me to go to a party with him
and
see
that
him.
They think you're hot.
Exactly.
Totally.
And see people flirting with him and oh yes, now I'm gonna take him home. He's coming
home
with me.
Because he's coming home with me.
Yeah,
totally.
Yeah, exactly.
And Esther Perel calls that the shadow of the third. Mm. There are ways to invite in what could be a risk and make it a good thing, that it injects sexual energy back into the couple. Like let's acknowledge that this waitress is super hot. Mm. And not kind of objectifying and at her expense, but if she's kind of flirty in the way she interacts with us while we're ordering food and then delivering it, let's talk about, so if a hottie like that was to come home with us, what would we do? Just generate the conversation and then go home and get busy with no intention of foisting your stuff on the waitress.
Yeah.
But acknowledge that somebody hot walked by. Let's see where that conversation takes us. Rather than feeling threatened by it, can we feel together about it? Can we be in on this?
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, guys, how do you feel? Is there anything?
I say let's do it. I say let's keep these mics rolling and hit the street and have some hypothetical crazy threesomes. No, I feel like we've reached that time.
Yeah. Yes. Is there anything itching that we feel like I need to talk about this?
Or I do have a series of strange itching sensations I need to talk about with Steph off mic. That's
what Oh, I guess when I wrap things up, it's always resource-based.
Right.
Polyamory Toronto is a meetup. And there's also the Ethical Lovers Group. They are a really smart bunch of people, very compassionate, having really honest conversations about alternative relationship structures or whatever. And those are all possibilities right here in the city.
And for those outside of Toronto, you mentioned Sex and You. Is it .ca?
Yeah. I'm not sure you'd get a very satisfying look at poly or kink through Sex and You. Basic sexual health, infections, relationships, pregnancy, absolutely.
Great.
But for poly and kink, probably less so. So, that's an interesting one. What would be the best resource for that? Anyway, well, sexualityandyou.ca is the one we talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. And yeah, in terms of poly and kink, it's just the ones I've mentioned, like OntarioKink.com. Or Polyamory Toronto, I guess, would be starting points.
And you have your monthly meetup?
Yeah, there's one coming on Thursday night, actually. Sex with Steph on Thursday night, 8 to 10 in the East End of Toronto. And this will be the last one for a while. It'll put on pause over the summer, and then we'll talk about resuming it in the fall. But yeah, it's been tons of fun. And I do find lots of people come needing some space around the open relationship thing. I have been careful not to make that the theme, because I don't want to impose my explorations on other people. Mm-hmm. But it keeps coming up. No matter what topic we have set for the night, that is a big theme for a lot of people. Huh. And they need a place to talk about it safely where they feel less judged.
Huh. That's very interesting. Do you think, not to jump back into an interview, but what does that... Does that speak to our time? Does that speak to that it is a big conversation that people want to have now?
I don't think it's necessarily just now. Maybe opening relationships is a bigger topic. Polyamory is definitely more visible than it used to be. The internet has allowed those connections the way it has allowed folks to find porn that they wouldn't have had access to earlier. The internet is absolutely opening up a lot of those topics. But the oldest profession has talked about husbands not getting as much at home for whatever reason. Like, there's a new baby in the house, and yeah, leave my body alone. Go get it elsewhere.
Right.
There are some cultures that have been more accepting of that than our own, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of polyamorous cultures, or polygamy is a different word, but whatever.
Right.
Sex happens. It's happened for a lot of people for a lot of time, for a lot of ways.
Right.
So I guess that's what it speaks to, is that people need a place to talk about this, and there's not a lot of non-judgmental corners to do it.
The more I learn about sex, the more that becomes the only thing I know about sex, is that it happens.
Yeah,
yep.
Definitely. Speaking of the internet, if you want to, if you like this episode, please, please, please share it on your Facebook, on your Twitter. If you have a response, whether you're correcting something we said or you just want to join the conversation, you can get at us on Twitter at
Explain Jamie.
You can get us on Facebook.
Explain it to Jamie. The group
is a page. All on SoundCloud. SoundCloud.com/explainittojamie.
ExplainItToJamie@gmail.com. Instagram. Explain it to Jamie.
If you Google Explain it to Jamie, we're now at a point in which it pops up. Which
will erupt out of your screen, enveloping you immediately.
Yeah. So do that, please. please share it. Tell your friends. Word of mouth is our best friend, and we will love you forever. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you again to Steph for popping in.
It was fun to be here.
Yeah, can't we'll be having Steph back for part three within the next 600 to 900 weeks or whatever it was. extremely long timeline was last time we said.
That's right. Well, we're just teasing them, guys. Yeah. We're just preheating
the oven before we stick the turkey in their butt
while they're strapped to a table.
Jamie, stop describing what's happening to me in real time.
Once again, thank you. Thanks for stay vigilant, stay active, stay with an open mind. I'm Jamie.
I'm Richard.
I'm Steph.
And this has been Explain It to Jamie. Woo! Woo!